Hello and welcome to this event to reflect on the role the Treasury plays in government. Does the Treasury wield too much power over government? I'm the IFG's Chief Economist, Gemma Tetlow, and I'll be chairing today's event. And today's event will draw on a report that colleagues here recently wrote looking at the Treasury's orthodoxy. The Treasury is perhaps the most powerful department in Whitehall. Its ownership of public spending means it has direct control over the money available to all parts of government, while its responsibility for economic growth and for tax policy gives it enormous influence over the incomes of households and businesses. But criticisms of the department's influence are perhaps as old as the institution itself, with frequent complaints about the so-called dead hand of the Treasury or attacks on the department's orthodoxy. And these sorts of critiques were what motivated us to do a report, which came out earlier this year, looking at this so-called Treasury orthodoxy. My colleagues found that many of the fiercest criticisms are significantly overblown, but at the same time also found that there are problems with how the department functions. And so I'm really pleased that we can be here today to discuss these issues, to look at what are the strengths and weaknesses of the Treasury, and what, if anything, could be adapted in future. To help us chew over all of this, I'm really delighted we've got an excellent panel of people. So on my immediate left, we have James Bowler, who is Permanent Secretary of the Treasury. On my far left, we have David Gawk, who is former Chief Secretary of the Treasury, Lord Chancellor and Secretary of State for Work and Pensions. On my right, we have Anita Charlesworth, who is now Director of Research at the Health Foundation and also a former Director of Public Spending at the Treasury. And on my far right, we have my colleague Giles Wilkes, who's a senior fellow here at the Institute for Government and was one of the authors of our Treasury Orthodoxy report. A few brief housekeeping notes before we get started. We will be live tweeting from our @IFGEvents account, so please do follow and tweet along. We'll be using the hashtag HMTreasury. If you're watching online, please do start sending in your questions via Slido. You can do that on the right-hand pane. If someone else has asked a question that's similar to what you were going to ask, please just up-like it so that we can see that it's popular. And if you're happy to add your name and where you're joining us from, that would be really helpful so we know who we're talking to. But without further ado, Giles, let me come to you. Tell us a bit about the report that you wrote. What did we find?
Thank you very much, Gemma. Yes, so first of all, I think it's important to remember the context in which we wrote it. 18 months ago, 20 months ago, there had been a Tory leadership campaign in which, very unusually, the question of the Treasury had become an actual political issue, attacks on the Treasury orthodoxy from Liz Truss, the eventual winner, but in fact across the piece. And so when that government formed, I think it's important to remember, and this is, I regret to tell you, just one of several quotes from Lenin I'm going to use today. I know I didn't wish to alarm people who come in, but there are decades where nothing happens, there are weeks where decades happen. The very first of the very striking events that took place in September 2022 was the abrupt and, in our view, very shocking dismissal of Tom Scholar, the then Permanent Secretary, suggesting that this wasn't just rhetoric for a leadership election, but was meant to be a proper battle about the meaning of this phrase, Treasury orthodoxy, and an attempt to, in heavy quote marks, do something about it. Now, we at the IFG, we were all set for a really massive battle, and I would say, you know, after relief, I would say there was a slight tinge of disappointment. It'd be disingenuous not to say that having gotten already for what looked like a multi-episode drama about this topic, it turned into just one 10-minute violent cartoon, as it were. But as well, it would also be disingenuous that to say anything, but we would have been very firmly arrayed on one side in this question. We are a very pro-institutionalist think tank. We believe that rules and norms and behaviours that Liz Truss and others were against are actually a good thing for government. So it would have been, if we'd written about the orthodoxy in the heat of all of that, it would have been quite a short comment piece saying no. And in fact, the IFG did comment at the time, it wasn't just hindsight, saying things like, Truss's approach is a change from the accepted norms of good government, which is as close to swearing as you can get in this country. So having removed that pretext, you might have thought we'd have dropped this topic, but there's a meme on the internet, which is the worst person you know has just made a great point. And we felt that actually there was something to be done here. By the time we'd been thinking about this, we realised, like, as Gemma implied earlier, people have been going on about the Treasury for a long time. And it was about time that somebody had a good objective look at this. It wasn't just sort of left versus right. It wasn't just people who want more spending or so forth. So even though some of the straw men that had been arrayed were easily knocked down, like the idea that the Treasury is against growth, which is quite ridiculous, or that the Treasury doesn't understand the dynamic effects of tax policy, these are both ridiculous, but still we realise that there's an awful lot to understand beneath the bonnet of Whitehall that this is the sort of think tank is meant to investigate. So we enjoyed, for the next 6-9 months, interviews with a fantastic array of current and former insiders of the Treasury and elsewhere, just to try to understand what is meant by this orthodoxy, what is the effect of it, what can it be credited with, and what can it be blamed for. And, you know, while accepting all along, we're just hearing a lot of opinions, but we needed to air these and discuss them and see what progress can be made. So I don't wish to give away all of the findings in case it stops all of you going off and downloading the report and reading it through. Some of the best bits are right at the end. But I want to give just 4 or 5 highlights. And the first one, and this sounds like the most obvious one, which is, you're not going to be shocked by this, but spending departments like money. And they're very sore when you take it away from them or they don't get what they want. And they will remember what they see as the bad decisions and they'll construct a theory off that. If you often discuss people, what do you think of the Treasury? They'll say, well, I had this brilliant idea and the Treasury said no. And that will become the sort of theory of the Treasury. Now, by the way, trust me, before you all get up and walk out, this is as kind as I'm going to be to the Treasury view, but it's not a valid criticism of a finance department that it is sometimes unpopular. If it was popular, there would be something really to worry about. The Treasury should be unpopular because spending control is extremely hard. There's inflationary bias. There's something called the common pool problem, which everyone has an incentive to take from the pool, but nobody has incentive to own the consequences of the whole thing not being affordable. There's a gap in time between the actions and the consequences of overspending. All of these must be acknowledged before you criticise a finance department. And to move on to my second Lenin quote, the Treasury is extremely aware that the best way to destroy the capitalist system is to debauch the currency, as we almost found out in September 2022. And also they know, again quoting him, that society is only 3 meals away from chaos. So the Treasury has a special responsibility for staving away extremes. And in our history, the extremes have often been financial crises. Now, the second most important point that we came up with is the Treasury may be powerful, but we found no instance that justified this sort of core Trussite concern that the Treasury gets its way despite what the politicians want. We couldn't find a single example of a policy where it's the Treasury wanted this thing and the politicians wanted that and the politicians were thwarted. When politicians want to change the Treasury, its core beliefs, the way it operates, we found numerous examples through history of that happening in cooperation with the Treasury. So the idea that there's a separate political force guiding this country that is somehow unaccountable is kind of ridiculous. You need to have a more subtle theory than that, I think. Third, it is incredibly politically responsive, in fact. A sort of a corollary to the last point. The people we interviewed think that serving the Chancellor is ultimately what they're there for, to a degree that is quite sort of heroic in some senses, but might even be problematic. And you might say that having budgets 2 times a year that enable you to please a Chancellor is a real problem. I mean, I'm not saying that the IFG has a what politicians want is a bad idea, anti-politics ideology, but when your problem is your kids are eating too much sugar, twice daily trips to the store is probably a bad idea. And so the Treasury, perhaps you might say that the Treasury is mean and firm to everybody except the Chancellor, and that sometimes needs to be sort of addressed. Fourthly, in terms of these criticisms of the ideology, we found it very neat to sort of link them up in an alliterative way. So to summarise them quickly for discussion, simplicity, scepticism, static thinking and short-termism. In other words, the idea that you use a very simple sort of microeconomic model, you're very sceptical of adventurous ideas, you assume that the basic structure of the economy can't be changed easily, and you prioritise short-term outcomes above long-term ones. Now, you can put arguments in favour of all of these things. Actually changing the world with great policy is extremely difficult. But if the government programme is an adventurous, complicated, long-term effort to change the very nature of the economy, these mindsets can make policymaking exceptionally hard. And politics is itself also prone to these failings, in particular the short-termism one. So the Treasury is aware of them, but sometimes those devices, in particular twice yearly budgets, are an accelerant of them. And finally, the most difficult matter to evaluate is this question of power. What we found continuously is that what we were hearing from interviewers was translated as the Treasury seems to have more power than everybody else in the room. Now, sometimes this makes sense. If it's a money question, they should have more power, frankly, because there's 20 or 30 spending departments on one side and just the Treasury on the other. But there's a reason that we agonise about the orthodoxy of the Treasury and we don't agonise about the orthodoxy of BIS or BEIS or DBT or DEFRA or CLG. And so whether or not it has flaws, they matter a lot more because the Treasury is a very, very consequential department, as Gemma said at the beginning. And their ability to have power over the rest of Whitehall is extremely significant for any government, including the next one. And with my so I'll end with my final Lenin quote. The way they seem to treat the rest of Whitehall is that trust is good, but control is better. And that control is something that the people on the other side feel somewhat sort of restricts their room for manoeuvre sometimes. But anyway, those are our major points, but I'll be absolutely fascinated to hear what James has to say.
Thanks very much, Charles. James.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for that. Thanks very much. The last time I was at the IFG, I had to respond, and they ended with, "The Treasury's like Millwall. No one likes you, and you don't care." I thought I might as well get my coat after that. But that was, I think that was perfectly fair, actually, and a totally reasonable summary. I welcome the report. It points to a whole set of areas that we can improve, but it also avoids stereotyping our staff, actually. And I also want to start with the events of October 2022 when Treasury orthodoxy was politicised.
Yeah.
I came in the middle of that juncture. And I make no apology at all when focusing on this to say that I'm fully behind supporting my staff and the fairly amazing job that they do. And I'll take the example of just the last budget because my memory's too short. The focus rightly on the numbers and the content, but to deliver a budget, you would honestly be genuinely astounded at the efforts and talent that is required to do that and the absolute best of British public service that shows. But you don't want to hear me say that the Treasury is perfect, and I don't want to be too defensive. So we're on a journey, and I'll try and walk towards all the things you've raised. Let's start with orthodoxy. So as you've said, the Treasury, like all of its global finance ministries, has an objective to place the public finances on a sustainable footing. That does involve asking people to live within the budgets, prioritise and saying the dreaded no word. It's an objective, and I was looking up the definition of orthodoxy on my way over here. It's not a belief, it's an objective. It's worth saying, why is there that objective there? And we'll come to, I think, a really important and sensible debate about long-termism versus short-termism, where there's lots to be said. I mean, it's worth saying that one of the things the Treasury has to do is deliver intergenerational fairness and indeed make sure that the public finances are fit for the next crisis. And surprisingly little is in the debate about those two things. You did a report recently on the role of the centre, and I think this comes to sort of the power of the Treasury thing. I can't do as good a job as Gordon Brown or John Major, who responded to that report. My view on the Treasury Cabinet Office role of the centre is actually a really straightforward and simple one, which is it's not a competition and it's not a zero-sum game. So a strong Treasury works best with a strong centre. And that's a centre with clarity on strategy, priorities and delivery, obviously emanating from the Prime Minister. And I think the report recognised that. It's right that budgets and spending reviews and wider strategy flow from that, set that strategy. And I probably should pause just a little bit when you look at the Treasury and people talk about power to remind us that, of course, the Treasury has ceded far more power than I think any other department by a long way. So the Treasury no longer does monetary policy. It's done by the Bank of England. The Treasury no longer does macro forecasting. It's done by the OBR. financial regulations done by a set of independent regulators. We've got a debt management office and a government shareholding body. You would struggle to find another department that has ceded that power, but more to the point, successfully done so, and not against the Treasury's will. I think a key comment, though, is the economics versus finance ministry discussion. And I am absolutely clear here that the department must be an economics and a finance ministry. These two issues can be in conflict, and it makes for a very, very good and lively internal debate, but that's part of great policy making. Does the finance ministry always win? And I think there's a sort of assumption that the finance ministry does always win over the economics ministry. Well, at the risk of being slightly flippant, a glance at the state of the public finances would suggest the finance ministry isn't totally winning. Obviously, correctly, the actions in COVID and indeed inflation, cost of living, have meant that, like advanced countries right around the world, you know, we've now got a heightened level of debt compared to our historical function. I'd also point to at least the last three fiscal events where we've seen a very long-term focus on growth, and I'll come back to this: labour supply, business investment, and tax. The balance there has been to keep borrowing and debt around the same levels rather than lower. Yeah. By trying to take the initiatives and policies to stimulate those. And on the whole issue of growth, it is clearly, post the global financial crisis, a huge challenge for the UK and a whole set of advanced economies that we now have much lower historical trend growth than we have had in the past. And I think it's very clear that the Treasury's current and future number one priority will be sustainable growth. That is very much the focus now, and it will be in the future. It's the reason why we have a highly expanded economics ministry. It's much, much bigger than it's been in the past. But some of that debate misses that actually growth is a whole Treasury thing. It's not a department within the Treasury. And growth is as much about tax, it's about spending, it's about financial services, and increasingly the international side of the Treasury. And it is a whole departmental effort. I think the commentary about short-termism is a genuine one. And I think the Treasury must consider the challenge of whether it's always long-termism, what more it can do. There's definitely a case to look at that with infrastructure and investment spending, for example, in mind. We have made progress. Let me talk to a few areas. I'll take one big policy we did recently, the implementation of permanent capital allowances, permanent full-time expenses. That is a policy that almost totally scores within our forecast period and almost totally benefits outside the forecast period. So, you know, the economics ministry was one up on that one, right? There was no financial benefit that from going that way. I'd also look to the really, really important and often, I'm afraid, underlooked at fact that the Treasury commissions the OBR to do a 50-year public finance forward look. It's pretty startling what that report shows, and it's a big challenge for the country when you look at it. And I can see Jill Rutter in the audience. I sat on this stage in 2016 making the case for one fiscal event a year. And the IFG did a report on it, and Philip Hammond announced it and enacted it in 2016. And there is a case for stability and certainty, like you say, Giles. I mean, in fairness, things have been pretty lively since. Obviously, Brexit, COVID, energy crisis. But I think that definitely is the way forward. I mean, Anita, I'm sure we'll come to this. On the issue of spending, I think this is where much of the short-termism debate also comes from. We're in the middle of a three-year, multi-year spending programme. There's five-year budgets in some areas, there's 10-year planning assumptions in others. I mean, suffice to say, this particular three-year spending review has been pretty lively. So much has gone on, COVID, inflation, that we have been back and forth with departments a lot. My hope and expectation and plan would be that we should continue with multi-year spending reviews, and that should be the Treasury setting departments and then delegating to them to get on with it and have that multi-year discipline. I recognise that, it's been tough in this current one. Success will definitely be us getting out of department's hair. And on the issue of, micromanaging, something we're also accused of, I can absolutely promise you that the people just across the park here and in Darlington and Norwich really don't want to be marking lots of people's homework. So we have increased delegated limits whereby departments can get on with stuff without recourse to the Treasury a lot. I think it's gone from 15 to 100 million in education, 10 to 200 million in Foreign Office. We obviously don't want to hear anything from the Foreign Office. But, you know, there is a micromanaging thing there which I'd like to, make more progress on. Look, I'll try and speed up a bit. Openness and collaboration, I think, is something. It's something when I came into the job, I said I wanted the Treasury to do more of, and I think the Treasury is doing more of. You take the recent Mansion House reforms to pensions, that's something that requires departments, the industry, the regulator, all to work together on a knotty issue where we've got common cause. We can certainly do more, and there's definitely a case of business engagement and business creation that we want to systematically and formally do better still. The one area I think that the report focuses on about secrecy is tax. I can understand that. We're trying to do better on tax. We're trying to do more like we do in financial services, consult a lot more, be a lot more credible. Creative industries and environmental taxes have all of that interdepartmental and business engagement. The big thing on tax, and David's here, the big nut we have to crack is how to get better at tax simplification and tax reform. We've had some bumpy rides here. You know, we've tried to simplify and get those knots out of the tax system. The example would be, though, that we do things and there's some winners who essentially stay pretty quiet, and there's some losers that scream really loudly, and, you know, it reaches Parliament and you don't get your reforms through. The Gordon Brown 10p rate abolition, Philip Hammond's NIC simplification. So there's definitely something we can do about transparency and making the case for long-term tax reform. Look, I'll end on another area you didn't focus on too much, but I think is important for the Treasury, which is sort of cross-cutting working. The Treasury has a key role in trying to break down the dreaded Whitehall silos. There's some good examples of what we're doing, but in all of them, I think we can do quite a bit more. Outcomes. You hear a lot about inputs, more and more and more about inputs. It's all about outcomes. Outcomes are all cross-cutting. There are 21 outcomes, which you probably don't see much focus on as much as you might at the moment. But for me, you know, Michael Barber's whole thing about it is absolutely key. Shared budgets. We've got a shared budget fund, but there are ways to deliver shared budgets. We can do more. And we've also got through the managing public money and accounting officer issues that allow you to share that. That's out there, but these now need to be enacted. And obviously the sort of cross-cutting challenge of our generation of net zero, where I am absolutely clear that the Treasury must, will and is playing an absolutely central role in that transition, which obviously is cross department, household, business and government, and is the challenge of our time. I'll end on one thing, one showcase, which I think is just really, really positive, and, you know, actually shows that, you know, permanent secretaries aren't in control, quite right. We have our new office in Darlington Economic Campus. It's got over 200, going on 300 Treasury staff there. It has a whole host of diverse thinking that goes into that policy creation. It also sits with all the other economic departments. So the idea of co-creation and sharing of ideas to generate things is happening. If I wanted to do an edict to say, do not talk to other departments, it would be useless. So, you know, there's a real positive future there. I'll conclude. I hope I'm not being too defensive about where the Treasury needs to change and that we're on a journey. I am, however, a big supporter of what the Treasury does. And I'll end where I started. I am defensive about the work and motives of Treasury officials, who it is an absolute privilege to lead. So thank you very much.
Thanks, James. Anita?
Yeah, I think where I start from is that this debate has been very much couched, because of where it arises, in the context of the UK's specific institution. But actually, I've been involved in some work at the OECD since 2008 on fiscal sustainability and the sustainability of public services. And this is a challenge that all high-income countries are facing. And it's a really substantial challenge, and it's one that is in everyone's interest that we navigate really well. So I think it's actually quite helpful to try to lift this away from almost like personalising this to an institution and the people in it, and to think a little bit more and focus a little bit more on the fundamental challenge, that in a way some of the tensions around the institutions are just the symptom of rather than the cause of. And if we come to fiscal sustainability and the sustainability of public services and think about coming out of COVID and cost of living crisis, and then over the next 5 to 10 years starting to really get onto the front foot around that, I think there are four big issues that the Treasury really needs to think of. The first is that actually it's not very good at financial control, at fiscal control. And I'll say this having worked a lot in the healthcare sector, where Andrew Dilnot and I think colleagues at the IFS produce what's called the hedgehog diagram, which shows the plan for health spending and the actual amount of health spending. And basically the system systematically overspends and the Treasury always finds itself having to bail out. And it's not the only area. And that's not because it's incompetent. It's not actually because people are malicious. But I think fundamentally, we have a problem in our system whereby whenever we go into an exercise of planning public spending, a spending review, we systematically underestimate the cost of continuing to provide services as is. And this is another point about openness. We don't have an objective in the public domain at the beginning of the spending review estimate of what it would cost to carry on. So the debate at the moment is 1% real, which is the sort of over public spending a target that's kind of in for the fiscal numbers. And everyone's saying, you know, we're going to abolish wait, all these long waits and all this sort of thing in the next 5 years, but stick to all those targets. Well, actually, if we carry on with public services as is, if we do that work, that's almost certainly more than 1% a year growth. So actually the question, if you like, that ought to go be very clearly within the public spending spending review debate is how are you going to get your common policy aligned with your planned spending? And if you want to do all your new and whizzy things, what are you going to do? Which brings me to the second point, which is the efficiency of public services. And I think this is a really important thing, which obviously is key to long-term sustainability. And this is where the long-term, short-term has been really, really damaging. So that, you know, so many of the things that we've done and which we get to sort of hide have changed the allocative efficiency of public services, biased us towards day-to-day consumption, you know, what Chris Giles calls the addiction to day-to-day consumption over our long-term resilience and long-term efficiency. So the bias that get away from capital, away from prevention, away from investment in the workforce, which manages pay pressures, not valuing actual resilience, so we push our system hard, those things. And then the other thing I think is the ability actually to align spending to actually government priorities. And because we don't have good measures to do that and we operate in a low trust environment, we then end up doing lots of micro control from the Treasury. And I spent many years in the Treasury working when there was quite a lot of money around, creating new whizzy things and ring fencing them because they were our thing, not a department's thing, and no one owned them. And I did a very big thing, which was a Wanless review, which put loads more money into the health service and said lots of things about what should happen to that money. But actually no one else beyond us owned that as an agenda. And so the money went in, but all those things didn't happen. And actually the system didn't become more efficient. And then the final thing, which builds on James's point around Darlington a little bit, is the extent to which we do all this nationally and drive it through the silos of individual systems, or whether or not we actually start to transform it really radically and allocate budgets to geographies and stop allocating budgets so much to particular areas of public services and genuinely let go. And I think that's a really important debate.
Thanks very much, Anita. Finally, David.
Yeah, well, thank you, Gemma. Well, I had the privilege of being a Treasury Minister for 7 years, six of those years doing tax policy, quite a lot of that time working very closely with James, 1 year doing spending policy, and also I had a bit of a view of the Treasury as a spending minister subsequently. And the conclusion I reached is that there are many things that are wrong with how our system works, but I don't think the Treasury is particularly one of them. Not to say that it's perfect. I can think of moments where things went awry that could have gone much better, but I was struck by the consistently high quality, strong sense of public service, a real desire to deliver for the country. And I think that the Treasury ethos, the Treasury orthodoxy, as Giles sort of quotes in the excellent report, is fundamentally right. I suppose politically, if you call these sort of political positions, but if you believe in keeping control of inflation, if you believe in sustainable public finances, and if you believe that the market by and large is a good way of allocating resources, I think the Treasury orthodoxy is entirely sensible. And obviously, we've talked about the autumn of 2022, a moment where at least one of those aspects was challenged, and we saw what happened. And the reassertion of Treasury orthodoxy in pretty short order in a crisis forced by the markets, I think, demonstrated that one can be very cavalier with things that most of us previously taken for granted. In terms of things that where the Treasury, I think, gets caught up is in criticism is very often, as I say, consequences of other failures within the system. Do we have a problem with short-termism in how we are governed? Absolutely. It's a massive problem. But I think those of us who've been ministers have to take a bit more of the responsibility here rather than dumping on the officials. And if we're looking even within government, you hear the argument about if only we could spend this money here, a spend to save idea. And look, I was a spending minister and I've tried those arguments. In fact, even when I was in the Treasury, I was essentially the spending minister for HMRC and used to run a lot of spend-to-save arguments that actually very often prevailed, and we did get additional resources for HMRC in particular projects. The fact is departments could do more. The departments could make tougher choices and could reallocate resources more in a long-term direction, and it's very often the Treasury that is making the argument that they should do so, and the resistance is coming from elsewhere within the government. I say other departments, that's not always just to blame the officials. I think you also have to look at sort of spending ministers here who, again, are very often not prepared to sort of take on vested interests, are looking very often for a quiet political life, are conscious that they are not going to be around for when they get for the benefits of spending money in a way that has longer-term benefits. Those, I think, are the real problems. And I don't think this is fundamentally driven by the Treasury. I also want to say I largely agreed with everything that was in the report, and I think it's really helpful to come back to this. And the sort of anti-institutionalism that was represented in the Truss government, that may have gone, but it may well return in another form before that much longer within my own former party. So I think some of those arguments need to be sort of properly addressed, and it's astonishing how quickly some of these arguments are sort of now being made by Conservative MPs, that if only we cut taxes, everything would be fine. But I just want to sort of turn to one criticism that was made that I do slightly question, which is on the issue of transparency with other parts of government on tax. Now, I appreciate there are particular areas, environmental taxes, energy taxes, perhaps on the creative industries. James has sort of touched upon this. But I can recall my time in the Treasury very often having to field suggestions coming in particular from Number 10 as to what we could do with the tax system. And I can tell you that those ideas, I think, were without exception terrible. And look, I know what the criticism is of our tax system that tends to come from think tanks such as this and tax economists more broadly, and indeed lots of sort of tax professionals who might argue, look, there are too many distortions in the system, there's too much uncertainty, there's a lack of strategy, there's a lack of a long-term plan. I would point to tax policy working well, which was when the Treasury put together a strategy on corporate taxes, and that worked very, very successfully. But if you kind of take the economist or the professional view of what our tax system should look like, for which I have a huge amount of sympathy and tried, usually unsuccessfully, to try and move us in that direction, why did that not happen? Largely because of public opinion, the winners and losers point that James mentioned. He kindly skipped over the budget of 2012, in which I think we were both quite involved. And I certainly still bear the sort of scars. But a lot of those policies, frankly, were perfectly sensible simplifications that went badly wrong because they were unpopular and because the losers made an awful lot of noise. I could also say that, If you want to be moving into a sort of purer, sort of Merlis approved type tax system over here, and the Treasury sort of wants to go this in that direction, but is stopped by the politics, if you started giving more power to individual departments and Number 10 to try and shape tax policy, we'd be heading off way in that direction, because every department would be thinking, here's a good way of meeting a sort of spending pressure. We'll have a tax relief for this, a tax relief for that, and in the end, our tax system would become even more complicated and distortionary and unpredictable. So I say, defend Treasury orthodoxy. I think James is absolutely right to defend the officials within the Treasury. And we need to focus more on some of the problems which I think are driven more by politics and the sort of hyper-responsiveness to short-term public opinion. And if anything, we want to be strengthening institutions. I accept that might not just be the Treasury, but we should be strengthening our institutions, not weakening them.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, David. So before I go to questions from the floor, we've already got quite a lot coming in online as well. I'd like to ask a few of my own questions. The first one I wanted to pick up on is something I think you all mentioned to some degree or another, which was around short-termism. I just wonder if you could each say a little bit more about what do you think at the moment perhaps does drive a tendency towards short-termism and what you could see as a way of countering some of that. Charles, I'll start with you.
I would say the most obvious driver, sorry to nick this one early, is the twice, or sometimes seems to be more than twice every 12-month fiscal moment, which, as James implies, is sometimes absolutely necessary. It clearly was during COVID because the economic picture was changing incredibly fast and it needed to be responded to. But British voters tend not to pay very much attention to politicians most of the time, and then they pay a lot of attention around fiscal moments, and politicians really love responding to that. And I think that can be a real driver of short-term policymaking, in particular this asymmetry that has come with the fiscal rules, and I don't really know how to resolve, which is when things get better, their little surplus opens up and there's an opportunity to play with some money. And when they get worse, you suspect that they'll just, let's do it every 12 months instead. So I think that's a real driver and a kind of a ratchet on the fiscal system that means we will lose our room for manoeuvre fiscally if they have too many opportunities. So that's my favourite.
A couple of things I'd suggest. We have a forecasting horizon, which is, 4 years, and then long-term fiscal sustainability, which is 50 years. And I think some of the really interesting things are the decisions that you're taking now, what impact do they have over 10 to 15 years? And that is completely opaque in our system. The other thing is, actually, I've been arguing in some work I've done on prevention to create a new category of prevention spending, because sometimes one of our problems is that if ministers and governments do the right thing and do take tough decisions in order to invest in the things that will have long-term benefit, there's very little way of getting credit for that and creating political capital for that. And then actually, if you cut those things and you prioritise the myopic over the longer term, actually in our system you can hide that quite well and there's very little accountability for that. Now, it doesn't change the fact that fundamentally these are really difficult decisions, but we actually do make it quite hard for people. And now I think the challenge for the Treasury is that opacity and not boxing things in create some of the wiggle room for them when things are difficult. So I think the Treasury is often deeply conflicted about this because, but I think just as it was with monetary policy and forecasting, it said actually overall, although this reduces our room for manoeuvre, if we take at the bigger picture, it is actually good for us and good for our ability to actually help ministers to actually really think through the long-term consequences and make better quality decisions. We're a democracy, so it's completely legitimate still to say I'm not going to invest for the long term, but to be accountable for that, but also to get the credit and create some political capital for when you do the right thing.
James.
Look, I'll build on that, really. I would say there's short-termism in the scoring side of things. It's a five-year... I pointed to the fairly significant full expensing of capital allowances or something where you have to sort of, in that scoring period, you have to bear the costs even though you know the benefits are coming down the line. The thing I'd say in fairness to that is, the OBR that there's been much sort of mused about dynamic scoring, but actually the OBR do a second round effect of policy. Mm-hmm. So, and that has actually allowed, for example, really rather substantial increase in childcare policy that addresses one of the big, big changes that is happening right now with this big rise in inactivity to say, well, what can we do about our labour supply? And if we expand the size of the state, will we get some economic growth back? Mm. And the OBR literally tells you the answer to that now, where it didn't so much in the past. I mean, I'll flip it slightly on its head just to do it. There is another version of short-termism, which is, we're in power for 5 years, so we want to get it done now. Someone has to pay the debt interest and the debt back at some point. So this, I do think, I mentioned it, this intergenerational point. And, of course, the global financial crisis knocked debt up by about 20 percentage points. COVID and energy put debt up by another 20 percentage points. There will be another crisis. So are we ready?
I mean, since you're on this point, I mean, in your opening remarks, James, you mentioned the OBR's 50-year risks and sustainability report. Is your sense that them doing that and looking at those sorts of risks has actually changed the sorts of policy that we're making, how we're adjusting?
It has, and it's real best in class. The IMF and OECD love it, and lots of other countries are trying to copy it. To tell you what it says, it goes straight to demography, healthcare, and the fact that a smaller working age population has to pay for a larger non-working age population, and it then runs current policies and tells you what debt would be, and spoiler alert, it gets over 300%, I think. Mm. So that is, it really does show the challenge. I mean, have we done the suite of policies that address that? No.
I mean, I would build on Anita's point as well in terms of the sort of opacity that could exist with some spending decisions. I mean, the particular idea that I sort of mention whenever I get the opportunity is could you have, for example, some another office, another independent body, an Office of Spending Evaluation that essentially categorises all public spending and, you know, has a kind of gold star award for those bits of spending which are likely to reduce future demand for public services or increase productivity and therefore increase tax revenues, and kind of categorise a department's spending as such. And, you know, if any minister comes along and reduces the sort of category one, the gold star spending, that becomes much more apparent. If a minister is able to increase spending in that area, it kind of, you know, it might not be picked up on the doorsteps all around the place, but, you know, people in this room, organisations like this would highlight it, and you can kind of increase to some extent the political rewards for spending well rather than spending badly. I would put that in the context. I agree with James. You know, debt is a real problem. That's not a free gift to say here's some good areas of spending and therefore we can do much more of it. It's about reprioritization, and, you know, quite possibly identifying the Category 5 spending for which there is, you know, no long-term benefit for productivity or in terms of reducing demand for public spending, and, you know, maybe we could cut some of that.
Right. Second question I want to pick up on, which particularly James and Anita, you both talked about, was around the Treasury's sometimes micromanagement of spending in other departments and the idea that actually the Treasury doesn't really want to be doing this, but sometimes it can be hard to sort of make sure that central priorities are delivered within the budget. What do you each think about what could be done a bit differently to make more progress in this direction? I'll go in reverse order, David.
I was hoping you were going to leave me to sort of last on this one. I think if we're looking at getting spending priorities sort of right, look, where I think this harks back to IFG's last report about improving sort of coordinate, you know, working out as a government what are your priorities and getting finance and getting reform combined together. And there isn't enough of that. That is a weakness within the system, and whether that needs to be sort of strengthened at the centre, in terms of the sort of Cabinet Office and Number 10, and moving in that direction, I think that's probably where you need to go. And as I say, I don't think the fault really lies with the Treasury for, again, as the report is, you know, it's the one bit of the system that's sort of working. But if you can get that combined, and one of the, I mean, when I was the Chief Secretary and Ben Gummer was the Minister for the Cabinet Office, you know, we were working quite hard to try to align the sort of annual departmental report, which I think anyone sort of ever read, but, you know, setting out the objectives with the finances so that the two can go together. And if you can move in that direction, I think that would be positive.
James.
And you also did the letter saying what your taxes actually go on.
Yes.
I'll be quick. I mean, the multi-year spending thing is the right answer, and I won't reiterate why it's been hard yards recently. Delegation is absolutely the right answer. I think it's about incentives to reform, increase productivity. Obviously, we've got this huge AI opportunity coming. Efficiency, and I just reiterate the point I was trying to make on outcomes, because, I mean, Anita's right, so much of this is, I've got a problem, I am spending 100 million, it's always 100 million, on that problem in a pot that's ring-fenced. You know, what people want to know is you're actually changing the outcomes here, so.
A couple of things. I think we also need to recognise that it does arise for a real reason, and this will be an interesting thing if we get a change of government next year. New governments want to change things and do things differently. And they're very and they want to do it in a way that delivers impact over a reasonable time period. And status quo bias in the delivery of public services is really quite profound. So if I take the NHS that I've worked on for my career, every government I've ever worked for or with has been committed to shifting services out of the hospital upstream and into the community. And the situation is now that we spend less on primary care, prevention and diagnostics than we do on emergency care. Yeah. So actually, the challenge of transformation is hard. So the confidence that if you give resource and you set priorities that it will happen is low, and that's not unfounded. So actually, linked to this with the wider reform of the centre is how do you actually get transformation in public services? Yeah. And simply setting people a target and saying what your policy ambition is seems necessary but not sufficient. And one of the things that I think is quite interesting in the Netherlands, I had a conversation with people in the Netherlands a few years ago about spending reviews, where in that conversation where you're using the same words and meaning totally different things. And we do spending reviews as a treasury-led exercise to look at how to allocate whole budgets. And actually, in the Netherlands, they do spending reviews led by and large by the permanent secretary of a department that has a role in that area of public spending, that goal. And they say, are we spending, what is all the money that we're spending on this goal? Are we spending it really well? How would we spend it really differently? So one of the things that might be quite interesting is this: if we had a government that had missions, would we do a spending review that is a rather different thing, that said, let's put someone who actually is going to be leading delivery of this in charge of looking at everything that we do, and saying, actually, if we really wanted to reorientate our system to deliver this mission, what would we do differently and how would we spend our money? And that's an input then into the resource allocation decisions. But their spending review is much more what we talked about in terms of comprehensive spending reviews, so it's never been comprehensive in my lifetime, which actually look at what's all the spending we're doing here. Spending reviews are always about the marginal pound, you know, and how does it align with our overall objectives? Is it efficient? Is it effective? And how would it be different? But not the Treasury telling people that, actually making the people who are going to lead on that lead the thinking, and then it's all published. And that's really important. It's all published before you make your resource allocation decision.
Very interesting idea. Mm-hmm. Giles.
It tells you how hard this question is that I had all the 5 minutes David wanted, and I don't have a neat answer there. I would say part of the answer is to try and take some of what Anita said there, that our cabinet level system of government, if the Prime Minister at the outset has really clear objectives for his cabinet ministers, he selects them with a really clear mandate that this is why I'm giving you this delegated authority to be a cabinet minister under me, and you're going to pursue these objectives, the micromanagement shouldn't need to happen if that conversation has been adequately governed in the first place and is then sort of followed up at that level rather than at the lower level. So ideally, we wouldn't have the slightly crazy system we have sometimes of ministerial appointments here, and often far too rapid, but really clear objectives handed at the beginning. And then I suspect this is how really big, complicated companies do it. They don't have a central function then interfering at every single level. They appoint the divisional heads competently and then say, this is what I want you to do, and fire them if they don't work. So I think that's where the problem lies, rather than the micromanagement is a sign that the other bit hasn't worked.
Great, thank you very much. So we'll come to questions from the audience now. If you put your hand up, there's a roving mic coming round. Please do say who you are before you ask the question. I don't think there's anyone in the adjoining room. No, okay. And for the online audience, I will also put in some questions that you've been submitting as well. So go first to the lady here, and then the two ladies on behind there, and then I'll come for a second round.
Thank you very much. And my name's Grace Duffy. I'm from Bridges Outcomes Partnerships. Bit of a mouthful, sorry. But I wanted to pick up the points, particularly James's points about outcomes and cross-cutting work, and Anita's on prevention. So very briefly, we deliver services for people with kind of complex, multiple needs on the basis of outcomes contracts. So we get paid when sort of long-term outcomes are achieved and evidence, rather than on the basis of inputs, which inherently means quite lumpy expenditure and that the benefits accrue to kind of multiple departments. And what we see from commissioners at a local authority level and at central government level is that they do really struggle to commission services in this way, which are often preventative interventions in things like children's social care or health healthcare, which are huge drains on you know, big sort of budgetary pressures. So things like the Shared Outcomes Fund is a really sort of welcome. So first quick question to James is, are we going to have more of that, please? But I think the second sort of broader question is really what needs to change so that that kind of approach that you've talked about being sort of in a multi-year and focusing on outcomes, that actually translates to the way that services are commissioned and delivered at a local authority level, at an ICB level, because I don't really think the right structures and incentives are in place to do that kind of preventative and outcomes-focused work. Mm. Thank you. Great.
Thanks. And then the lady in the white and blue shirt.
Thanks, Phoebe Bright from Treasury. Could you argue that growth is the new orthodoxy?
Right. And the lady just too along to the right there.
Hi, Liberty Hibbard from the Civil Engineering Contractors Association. Obviously, we've lost a bit of our way with industrial strategy since BEIS became BAT, so this is probably particularly for James. In the last autumn statement, a star chamber was announced to look at industrial strategy and speed up infrastructure delivery. That we've since heard basically radio silence on this star chamber. Do you know if there's been any movement on that at all? Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. So we'll take those three. You feel free to answer any or all of them as you feel able to do it. James, I'll start with you because some of those.
Sure. So look, so the Shared Outcome Fund, I think it's been £600 million in the end. But I think, and Anita will help me, you know, payment by results has been difficult to land. And obviously probation would be an example, perhaps a big example. But I mean, I couldn't be more passionate about going on an outcome basis. My thought would be don't go for too many targets and have everything for everything. Focus on a small and limited number, which doesn't, it's a question, I think, I think it's definitely the direction of travel. Is growth the new orthodoxy, you know, discussed? Well, that's the next IFG report. I mean, I think it's the new imperative, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's the new imperative because, you know, there's and we've all alluded to it, there's just the raw maths here that we've had public services growing at 3-4% when you've had historic trend growth at 2.5, 3%, 2.5 maybe. You've now got trend growth more like 1-2%, but the pressures on that public service remain. So growth is the answer for living standards, wealth creation, revenue generation, and therefore public services. So the new imperative is my IFG report title. On industrial strategy, and Giles can talk well about industrial strategy, I mean, I think I would say on the broad brush point that, and I full credit to Jeremy Hunt here, the last three fiscal events that he has delivered have been long-term economic growth focused, and they have addressed, I think, very importantly, labour supply at a time of rising inactivity, business investment at a time of comparatively lower business investment, compared to other countries, and you know, trying to incentivise work. But I'm not giving you a great answer to whether the star, sorry, I'm looking at the wrong person, whether the star chamber's met or not, so apologies for that.
David.
James mentions probation, which is an issue that I remember not so fondly, having to sort of clear up some of the difficulties there for what, you know, proved to be sort of too complex a contract to be done in the way that it was done, and payments by result didn't work in that particular context. I absolutely, you know, the point about sort of different silos, about trying to find a way in which you could incorporate the benefits that run across departments, to some extent about getting upstream as much as possible, is really important. I think there is certainly a well worth looking at the whole point about whether devolution allows more to be done in this area, because you know, if it's too complicated to do some of these things across national departments, is it easier to be done in localities than perhaps sometimes it is? But you know, James has touched on some of the difficulties in contracts here. Look, on growth, look, I am, you know, one of the better things about politics at the moment. So we have moved more towards the politics of growth. Both the big parties are essentially, you know, coming forward with their plans for how to get growth going again. You know, whether either is particularly compelling is another matter, but at least there's a sort of willingness rather than, you know, for years it was all about, you know, how do we deliver greater sovereignty or how do we crack down on immigration, etc. I think, you know, the focus on growth is to be welcomed. Just to make a point in defence of the Treasury, if we were really serious about growth, we'd have done bolder planning reform some time ago. The Treasury wanted to do that, but we didn't. If we were really serious about growth, we wouldn't have left the European Union. I don't think the Treasury as an institution was particularly enthusiastic about doing that either. We did those things because, or we didn't do those things because of public opinion. And, you know, again, it's politics that has got in the way of pursuing pro-growth policies. I hope public opinion is now shifting on that, because the consequences of not growing the economy is clearly very unpleasant.
Anita, I think Grace had a kind of second part to her question, which was, I think, why some of the sort of multi-year outcomes-focused flexibility doesn't always flow down to sort of subnational level. Was that?
Yeah.
Do you mind picking up on that?
Yeah.
Or something else?
And I think there is a real tension here, which we need to acknowledge with some of this idea, the ideas of kind of outcome-based contracting, but also saying to public services and departments, here's some outcomes and here's some money. One on the outcome-based contracting is the issue of attribution, which is hugely complex. The fact that actually with most public services, we can't effectively risk transfer. So if it actually does all go wrong, the state will pick up the cost of that. And that's just a basic reality. Ergo, if we're concerned about the public finances are exposed to a risk which they cannot manage and cannot understand, and that's problematic, yeah? So we need to think about how to do that. And then we have an intertemporality problem and a credibility problem, in that almost all of these schemes, for completely understandable reasons, say we'll spend loads of stuff now for the gain later on. And will we get the gain, yeah? And so I think it's quite hard to do this in quite an unfettered way. I think probably public spending services, it's unrealistic. There are questions, therefore, about where we can try to get our system to move more in that direction. The other problem is that actually the Treasury, in all my years of working for it and with it, are very keen on things, prevention and moving the dial. And quite often then, part of the problem is that there aren't the ideas around. And actually, so also thinking about how you, if you did want to move the state to a much more preventative approach, which I think would be hugely in our interest, how do you do that in a managed way that ensures the resources are being spent well? Which comes back to the other point I would make to the new orthodoxy. I don't think it should just be growth. I think it should be growth. But what James talked about was the compounding factor of two numbers, yeah? And the collision of compounding on those two numbers. We need economic growth so we can afford everything, but we need to maximise the long-run productivity and efficiency of all of our public services, because structurally, with an ageing society and all of the other tensions, you know, and the nature of market failures that we've got around, actually, there are enormous pressures for the state to do more. So if the state can do that more efficiently, yeah, that growth side is slightly lower. And if we get economic growth, you know, then the revenue side is that bit bigger, and the gap just gets smaller, which is where you get fiscal sustainability. We need both to move.
Charles?
Just very quickly on the growth one, I mean, I looked up the Fundamental Expenditure Review from 1994. It's something that was written by a brilliant young official called Jeremy Hayward, I understand. It had growth in it back then. I mean, it's something about driving well-being and prosperity through growth. I think it's always been there for the Treasury. I know that there were phases when we said that not everything in life is growth. It kind of peaked around 2009 when David Cameron, I believe, talked a lot about general well-being. And I think then we saw the size of the deficit and reasoned that until the bond market wants to be repaid in smiles, it's GDP we actually need. So on the matter of industrial strategy, I'm fascinated by the question of whether the Treasury's orthodoxy is going to be flexible enough to a shift towards industrial strategy. I think it's one of the key questions of the next 24 months, given what we expect to happen at the next election. That stuff about infrastructure delivery is a really important component of that. And in particular, the Treasury is a fantastic analytical department. Does it know how to analyse questions of delivery and getting things moving quickly? Because tax policy is instant, but delivery of infrastructure just isn't. And there's a fantastic report from as long ago as 2010 about how the Spanish and Portuguese and French build metro stations for a fifth of the cost or something. This is something that we've been waiting too long to do something about. So it's a great question.
I'll take some questions from online now. So the first one comes from Andrew Pearce, who asks, how do we move away from the use it or lose it mentality you see in many departments with their budgets every year? Should we be allowing more flexibility to roll over underspends to provide flexibility? Martin Wheatley asks, it's widely accepted that the UK, specifically England, is over-centralised, not least the very low proportion of revenue raising and spending controlled locally. Is this the Treasury's fault, or do the reasons lie elsewhere and perhaps could extend the question to say, are we in the right place? Should we shift on this? And we have an anonymous questioner who asks, how can the Treasury do more to ensure that policies are funded in a way that allows for robust evaluation so we're confident we know what works? So, Giles, do you want to...
On the end-of-year financing, it sounds like a great idea. It's one of the things that's a total mystery to people who come into government for the first time is to find that money doesn't have the tangible, enduring aspects that we're associated with in the real world. Money disappears at the end of the year. But it was also end-of-year financing rolling forward that produced that black hole that needed to be addressed in 2010. So it can be abused. I do think money should be more money-like, so we should find ways of making that the case. And I agree with that very much. The centralisation of our system is a long-standing fact. It's got to be politicians' fault. Anything that's long-term, it has to be the politicians' fault. I mean, I think Andrew Marr wrote a book called Ruling Britannia in the mid-90s about how local government had been stripped of all of its powers. This is a really long-standing one. It used to be that local government did everything apart from national defence and things. We need to move back in that direction, but it has to be a political question. And, those are the two substantive answers I have.
I think the end-year flexibility is a really interesting one because I was in the Treasury in a period where we were really worried that people were just not spending things and we were building up huge end-year flexibility. And I, you know, now work on a set of issues where actually that isn't a problem with our resource spend, but it is with our capital. Even with inadequate capital allocations in terms of thinking about overall efficiency, we underspend capital. And that links to, I mean, we were talking before about planning reform, but a lot of the way capital investment is planned, delivered and overseen in the public sector is appalling. If the problem were the allocation, purely the allocation of money, I don't think we'd see the both what we experienced in the 2000s and what we experience now. So just as to your point about kind of wider infrastructure investment, and this is where the strong centre is really important. We need to look overall as well at that. That delivery architecture.
James? I mean, look, difficult to add to the joys of end-year flexibility. I mean, those are the right discussions. You know, multi-year spending review is about, though, giving people the delegation and the tools to get on with it, and capital's certainly the biggest one on that if you want to get into long-term changes. On centralisation, much of my career, I'm very, very proud that Treasury is at the front of trying to decentralise, be it doing all the devolution deals with countries, regions, and cities. And it is the Treasury doing those deals. DLUHC does a great job too. The one I'm very excited about is the evaluation question. So you guys haven't talked about that. I love a bit of evaluation. This is absolutely the point. We've funded a whole unit to look at this. We're trying to get it much more mainstream through our government finance function. And it's just the real simple point about you spent all that money, did it have the impact you thought it was? Mm. And if it did, you might want to do more of it, and if it didn't, do less of it. And it is that learning cycle, and it's exactly what, you know, our friend the Green Book would tell us to do, and it's deeply important. So hurrah for Anonymous.
I think there's I sort of link the sort of end of year flexibility point, and particularly where Anita took it in terms of, you know, capital underspends, which then end up, you know, going into current spending. I mean, that was basically how the MOJ didn't fall over for year after year after year. But of course, it means that we end up underinvesting. And I think a point here about, you know, greater transparency as to where the spending is, and, you know, every time that trick, if you like, happens, bringing that to light. And I would combine it with the point that James picked up in terms of evaluation. That's where I come a little bit. So I don't claim that this Office of Spending Evaluation is the perfect model, but I think there's definitely something in the area of, you know, bringing out with greater clarity how well we are spending money. That requires evaluation, and it requires, you know, some kind of public oversight and transparency. And I think that is would be an important improvement to the economic infrastructure that we have in place, architecture for that.
David, can I just ask you a follow-up question on that? Because I think our experience is that, if anything, government has become less keen to publish evaluations of policy, and there seems to be a great political nervousness about releasing that sort of information. Why is that? How could we persuade politicians that actually it's good to be open and honest? You try things that don't work, you can improve and get better.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot of nervousness. And look, you know, there are plenty of ministers. I'm, as it happens, not particularly one of them, but plenty of ministers have had quite bad experiences with the NAO, for example, and a sort of certain sense of, you know, ha-ha, you got it wrong, you know, it's not, you know, and it becomes a great political embarrassment. And I think you touch on the right thing about the kind of culture of, you know, sometimes you would want to sort of experiment. I mean, it's another, coming back to the previous set of questions, an argument for devolution is that it might give you greater scope to experiment, to evaluate, to compare, to learn. You know, a big sort of cultural shift. I think that is an opportunity for an incoming government to sort of to shift that, because for a long time, what's going to be evaluated is probably stuff that they didn't do. So politically, that becomes a lot easier. But if you can kind of present that in a, well, you know, we're going to be grown up and sort of lay the ground rules. But again, you know, there's a short-term political hit. If you're the minister that's, you know, pushed forward a pet project and it hasn't worked, then, you know, is your career in jeopardy? And, you know, it's understandable that ministers don't want to put themselves in that position. Does that make it a good system? Is that, you know, where we want to be? No. But that's the fear that drives it.
So we are unfortunately running very close to the end of time now, and I did want to ask you each a sort of final wrap-up question. So I'm afraid we won't have time to have any more questions from the audience, but you may be able to nab some of the speakers before they run away, or you may wish to run away quickly. But the final question I'd like to ask you all, and I'll start with you, Giles, because I gave you forewarning of this, and I'll give the others time to think about it, is, if you could change one thing to make the Treasury more effective in what it does, what would it be? This could be something you would change within the Treasury, or it could be something you would change in the wider context that the Treasury works in.
Okay, as having already given the answer about not having twice yearly budgets, I won't repeat that one because it seems to be cheating too much. But and I'm trying to remember what I was reflecting on what Rachel Reeves gave an important speech yesterday. Everyone only gets to do one May's lecture, so it's important to pay attention when they do. And she talked about strengthening the EGU and making it more pro-growth. Having listened to today's events and chatted to James as well before here, I don't think it's necessarily that's the answer, because the point is to the Treasury, everyone in the Treasury should be pro-growth. It shouldn't be like you're in charge of growth and you're in charge of environment, and we will have an argument from time to time. So I'd be saying, Make the Treasury more porous to outside suggestions, because in a really excellent piece of work that I read from Diane Coyle, I think, on industrial strategy, really good industrial strategy and economic ideas bubble up from the bottom up. They don't just get devised by a super brain at the centre and then disseminated, although it's important to have brainy people there. You need to be porous to ideas. You need to have great talent to know the bad ones from the good ones, and most of the ideas out there are very bad. But you, the Treasury ideally should become a more porous organisation that isn't like constantly lobbied around tax and has the sort of nightmare that David referred to there, but the ideas are not all going to come from the centre. So make it somehow more porous and more pro-engagement.
If I was picking one thing for an incoming government to do, I think I'd ask them to get an independent assessment of what the baseline is going into a spending review and have to publish that before the spending review happens. So there's some real transparency and accountability for the extent to which policy ambitions and spending plans are consistent.
Excellent. James.
Oh, I was hoping you wouldn't, because I then have to deliver whatever I'm going to do. I'd love to say something about making sure the staff are massively valued, but I'll pick something slightly different. It's been in and around this. You know, there's large amounts of policy development, but actually delivery matters. And I think, you know, in virtually everything we've talked about, it's the delivery, it's the outcomes, it's the, you know, the infrastructure, the thing. So I'd probably say, something around there.
I think the biggest challenge that the Treasury faces is this issue about sort of short-term versus long-term. As I argued earlier, I don't consider that the Treasury is particularly short-term, but it's operating in an environment where a lot of the pressures are short-termist. So I think, you know, perhaps a challenge for the Treasury is to come up with ideas, whether they be institutions or new conventions, and maybe Anita's, you know, highlighted one of them, that can shift us towards a longer-term approach. I don't think that's by any means completely within the hands of the Treasury. Largely, it is not. But whether there is something more that can be done that can pressurise politicians, perhaps reward politicians for taking longer-term decisions, I think there's a great benefit for the country if they could do that.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much. Thank you all for joining us for this discussion, and really big thank you to our panellists, to James, David, Anita and Giles. Thank you all so much for a really interesting discussion. The video and sound recording of today's event will be on our website and on YouTube shortly afterwards if you've missed anything or want to watch anything back. And please do join us for our next IFG event, which is tomorrow lunchtime, which will explore the recent impact of industrial disputes on public service performance, so somewhat related to discussions today. And if you want to sign up for updates on our latest research, please do join our newsletter, which you can do on our website. But thank you very much. Please join us in thanking the panellists.